बोधत भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमोतस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स अपरुद्धादिसङ्गमथस्थवराये सुरवन्धाभमुञ्जन्तु सदा
Just to make an announcement, somebody lost their car keys. We found a car key. So if any of you are missing it, and Venerable Amarnato, he's got it. We've got the car key. I always find these ordination days somehow very moving. It's quite, you think you're just going through some ceremony and they memorize Pali and all kind of the same thing, but it's, I think the commitment to the life is such a strong one that. And you can see that, like here in England, you don't ordain people all that easily because they go through quite a long period of training. So they, like Venerable Sawako and Kawesaka went through at least a year of Anagarika and then 2 years of Samanera. And so then they still want to take on the higher ordination. That shows an incredible kind of character that sees the value of willing to do that. Because it is what is generally referred to as renunciation. And the renunciation is, in a hedonistic society, is, I think, probably very inspiring. Because you're going against the whole kind of trend of the society you're living in. Renunciation then can be seen, a lot of people see it in terms of a kind of disparaging life, give it up and seeing it as bad or kind of like turning your back on it. So renunciation can have a kind of unpleasant feeling to it. And of course the modern life tends to want to affirm the world as that you should be happy and enjoy life. And so there's a lot of affirmation in modern life that wants to just endlessly seek for happiness. So like modern materialism and the modern fashions, they're an endless pursuit of trying to have an interesting or fascinating, exciting or happy life. But then when people incline towards meditation, they usually get weary of that because too much happiness, too much excitement, too much adventure, too many romances, too much fun, it all gets so boring. So you get tired of just seeking for happiness and an interesting life. So that's a good sign when somebody awakens to the fact that there may be something more important than just the endless distraction or seeking pleasure and happiness from this life that we live. Of course, many of us do have strong feelings, intuitions, more intuition than feelings, that there's something more to life than happiness. The renunciation then is seen not as a kind of, it's not an ascetic renunciation, it's not in order to control ourselves and to, because we despise the world. It's not done from a negative position, but it's done from the interest in simplifying life. So like monastic life is a simplification. It's a form or a lifestyle, as they say, that makes life very simple, because you're living in a way that your needs are minimal. You don't have a high standard to maintain, and you're living in a moral vehicle. So your relationships with people are based on kind of morality rather than on just personal feelings, and then your intention is to realize the truth, awaken to the Dhamma. So you couldn't, you know, and when it comes to that, that's quite a wonderful thing. Somebody wants to awaken, realize the truth, be free from suffering, and live a simple life. So I noticed this, I've been a monk now 34 years, 35, and it does get, it gets into increased simplicity. Because when I first started, and before I even ordained, I was getting incredibly complicated. I was about 32 when I became a monk, so I was very complicated by 32. That means I was neurotic. Complex, complicated, and confused. So that the three C's. Because life had been a pursuit, you know, of trying to find, you know, myself and something that I wanted to do with my life, and I couldn't really see anything that compelled me, that really I wanted to give myself to in any way, such as a profession or any of the options that were available to me. I'd worked in, I'd been in university, I was training to become a lecturer. I thought, well, I'll become a lecturer in Chinese history. So I did degrees at universities to get qualifications in Asian cultural studies, but then I knew that wasn't what I was really interested in doing. But I couldn't think of anything else. I've never really wanted to be wealthy or ambitions on that level. But then when I came across Buddhist monasticism, then that solved the problem, because it offered a lifestyle, a way of living your life that seemed integrated. You know, it wasn't just a profession you did on a certain time of the day and had weekends off. It is actually, you know, whole life that you developed, and that's what really interested me, was working on that level, to not be fragmented. And I saw in my own family in America that, you know, the endless conflicts around profession, family, and the problems that my parents had were, you know, their life always seemed bits and pieces and in fragments and not very well integrated into anything. So Buddhist monasticism, of course, is as I encountered it in Thailand, was I met Nongkhor Cha, and that was kind of what I'd hoped for, you know, kind of a monasticism that because a lot of what I saw in places like Bangkok didn't impress me at all. I was not, didn't really like the temples, the temple life in Bangkok. But when I saw the forest monasteries in northeast Thailand, that appealed to me, the whole, that kind of form seemed something that inspired and what I'd like to be involved with. But when I ordained, I didn't know, nobody could speak English where I ordained, so I just learned all these Pali phrases and I didn't know what I was saying. They just say, oh, say this, I'd say it. It wasn't anything like this ordination. Just tell me what to say next. It's like nonsense syllables, you know. That seemed to be all they, you know, we went through the formalities. Then as later I began to really reflect on what I'd actually committed myself to. Alms mendicancy was one thing that shocked me a bit because I didn't realize to what extent that was, you know, like being dependent on alms, not having money. Because the temple I ordained in Nongkai, as soon as I ordained, they gave me money. So I thought, well, you know, you say you don't have money, but obviously everybody gives you money. So I didn't quite understand what it was all about, but I didn't really think about it too much. But when I met Ajahn Chah, then there's no chance of having any money. And when I went to the first week I stayed with him, you know, I found out that you're not supposed to have any money at all, any personal funds. And I had money at the time, so I gave it to somebody else, you know, on the sly. I didn't want anyone to know. But Ajahn Chah had eyes all over the place. He said, oh, so you have money, huh? And you shouts it out all over the place. Then my social background is one where you're trained to be independent. The ideal is to be, not to depend on others. It's kind of disgraceful to be in any kind of dependent relationship where you need the support from other people. So, I mean, I was so independent, you know, as soon as I was 16 years old, I started supporting myself. And I never, you know, when I left parents' home at 17, I never depended on them. I supported myself and took care of my needs and never asked for any help from my parents. So I was just kind of pride of being, you know, I take care of myself and I'm not a needy person that depends on others for anything. And then to find myself totally dependent. So that was, but then I wanted to understand it, why the Buddha established a monastic order on alms mendicancy, because it was quite intriguing to think that you've got this is the oldest probably monastic order that still exists in the world, you know, 2,544 years, managed to survive. And on alms, so that's a good record, you know. When you think of it, that's quite, seems, you know, in terms of the way my American mind thought, that seems quite amazing. Because it shouldn't work. Things, you know, based on such seemingly uncertain things, uncertainties as alms, depending on alms, shouldn't work or shouldn't last. But Lungpa Cha was very much pointing out that the Buddha's intention was establishing around the goodness and generosity of humanity. And he pointed this out, that wherever there are good people, then you can survive. They don't even have to be Buddhist or even religious people, but people who have compassion or kindness and are generous. So this also brought me into a way of reflecting on what the kind of beauty behind the establishment of an alms mendicant order, because like here at Amaravati or Chitthurst, you've got monasteries established solely on alms giving, free will offerings and that, and they work, in a modern European country like this one. So, and according to most people, when we first came to UK in 77, most people said you couldn't do it. Predictions were all negative. Don't be foolish. People thinking we should take up bookbinding or having some kind of business that we did. Make liqueurs and wine. So this sometimes, it brings you into a state of where you're looking at humanity in a different way. Like the negative view is that like the materialist view is that we're vain and selfish, and we can be bought, we can be easily deluded, and you can get us to do anything if you give us enough money. You can make people do what you want if you pay them off. And so there's this negative, cynical view of humanity, which oftentimes seems, quite real. If you depend on your view of humanity reading the newspapers, the London newspapers. But my view of humanity has been quite different as a Buddhist monk, because living on alms for 35 years is, I've experienced the other side, the good side. So this I want to make conscious, how not to deny the fact that human beings can be selfish and vain and corrupt and so forth, because that's certainly within all our experience and oftentimes that's the view that's held. But I think also we need to recognize from a spiritual perspective, the goodness of our humanity, that our humanity is something to respect, and because this good side is more real than the other, if given a chance, if given, if respected and given the chance, then people do rise up, and they find a lot of joy in their generosity and their goodness. Speaking about renunciation in the final stage, say, of total renunciation, because when you're taking it to enlightenment, then you're relinquishing everything. It sounds like a total wipeout. You give up your personality, your identity, everything. And then the more you realize that, the more you can give up, the happier you are. So happiness is not being anybody. And happiness, in this sense of happiness, isn't getting what I want, but not being anybody. So, like in meditation, you know, when you're trying to attain stages and get, like in many of us start meditation from the idea of wanting to get enlightened or get stages of, you know, feel we're getting some place. You know, like you go through university, you want to get a BA, MA, PhD, or you want to feel that if you've devoted your life so many years to meditation, you've got some kind of attainment for it. And so that's the conditioning of the mind, this attainment to get something back for the hard work you put into it. But I find that doesn't work, because it's there's nothing to attain. You know, it's not like you're trying to get something you don't have. What you're doing with meditation is you're relinquishing all the delusions that you have. So it's not a matter of getting enlightenment, but of letting go of delusion. So that's where the Buddha emphasized the mindfulness, this word sati, sampachanya, satipanya, where it says these words I really like, because they're very direct and point to the ability we all have of opening to life and letting go of our delusions through seeing the suffering that we create through holding on to these delusions. The biggest delusion is, I am this body. And so, this body is me, and I am this person. And so, the whole cultural conditioning is based on that delusion, that illusion of being somebody, being a body, being a person. And that, of course, is the cause of our suffering, because we're identifying all the time with what with something that isn't real. And then the sense of a self is conditioned into the mind, so it's always, you know, you're never quite sure who you are until unless you have to find some kind of reinforcement for your self-importance, such as approval from others, or having a position, or being considered attractive, or popular, or interesting, or worthy, or good, or whatever, having the approval, having some outward source of people affirming your identity. And then it can easily go into the opposite of being looked down on, being despised, being made fun of, being considered useless or unlovable and whatnot. So that the self is always, you know, it's a pretty shaky thing to be identified with, because it can easily swing from one to the other. It's like praise and blame. You can, you know, it's nice to be praised. Somebody says, I just made you're such a great, wonderful teacher, and it sounds nice. And then somebody else will say, you're hopeless, don't know what you're talking about. You can feel happy or sad according to the opinions of others. Or the body itself, you know, when you identify with it, it's something that isn't going to be what you want. So there's always something wrong with it in terms of vanity. You can see your nose is too big or small, or your chin is too, don't have enough big of a nice chin, or it's too big or it's too small, or your mouth is too big or too small. Cosmetic surgery is making enormous profits out of people's aversion to their bodies. They're trying to make them better all the time. And then, of course, even if you've got an absolutely perfect body, it gets old. And to sustain it, you know, it's so hard to keep it in any fit condition for very long, and then it gets pain and sickness and dies. So that the identity with the body is just a, you know, you're set up for a lot of suffering. So changing, say, the relationship from I am my body to this body is the way it is. It's you know, you're contemplating it in terms of it, of the experience of it, rather than according to some ideal, some idea you have of how what body should be. So you're noticing that it's what it is to have human, to have a sensitive form like this, to be in this sensitive state continuously from birth to death, where you're always, there's something always happening, pinging, irritating, on this body. Because when you really contemplate your life, it's been an endless procession of being irritated. You know, one right after another. And you know, you get cold, and you get hot, and you get hungry and thirsty, and it goes on and on, and and just coming from Sri Lanka and Thailand, well, you know, in Colombo, now you have mosquitoes, and it's too hot, and you're sweating, and then people talk about England is too cold, and I don't like that, where you get perfect temperature, and then you can have air conditioning now, and they have the perfect temperature, but then you get stuffy, and you get Legionnaire's disease, another problem. No matter what, how hard you try, it's hard to get anything to sustain itself in a state that you can be fully comfortable in and happy and not feel any kind of irritation. So reflecting like this, you begin to recognize the body is not self, and this isn't through convincing yourself, but it's through noticing, through awakened investigation of the experience of having a physical body. Because it's not like we're trying to convince you that your body's not you, but this kind of teaching is for reflection, to contemplate what is it to look at it in different ways rather than just assume, go from the assumption. So letting go of the body is renunciation. But then I find letting go of the body is not like trying to get rid of it. It's not asceticism. It's not aversion to the body, or trying to just dismiss it as something nasty. Then it's learning how to live with it. You know, so we have sila and ways of living that are respecting the needs and demands of the physical body. Like when the Buddha, before he was the Buddha, did the 6 years of asceticism. You know, these gruesome pictures of him all looking like a skeleton with his stomach completely kind of hollowed out, and all, you know, see all his ribs, and it's because trying to discipline the body through trying to not let it, not to kind of frustrate all its desires. And that's another road to misery. So it's not a denial, not a asceticism, nor is it an indulgence in just trying to have pleasure through the body, but in understanding through awakened awareness and recognition of, and learning from this experience of the physical sentience that we experience as a lifetime as a human individual. So it's interesting, when I went to, before I went to Sri Lanka, I had this strong insight about not having any past. In So then I go to Sri Lanka, and then everybody introduces me with these kind of, the whole, you know, these kind of biographies. And they're all over the top, you know, about how I was a medical doctor in the Navy. And they never get the facts right. And or an airplane pilot in Vietnam. And then I've done fantastic things, you know, according to these biographies. But then they're noticing that when I hear this, you know, it all sounds so, doesn't, you know, if you don't have any past, then it's like, that's kind of meaningless in a way, but yet you recognize that people want something to see me, you know, to define me as being somebody special. But in terms of renunciation, then it's more, there's nobody, and not being anybody, not having any past, it seems joyful. It's quite joyful not to have to be anybody. But you have to realize that, you know, yourself. Don't believe me, but this is for reflection. Because when you are somebody, then of course it works that when somebody says you're a great teacher, then that makes you, that affirms a sense of yourself as being a person of worth. And then somebody says you're no good, then that does the opposite. But if there's no self, no person, then people say whatever they want, you know. It's all kind of like empty and meaningless, and not taking it, not taking it in a personal way. So renunciation is liberation. But renunciation also it can't be done as a willful act. Reject, because Nekamma Bharami, or one of the virtues that are developed in the holy life, is not a willful act of rejection or denial, but it's a growing understanding of liberation through not being attached, and through being able to relinquish the attachments that we find that we have. So today is a special day. These two new bhikkhus, Savako and Kavesako, and then Samanera Yanadasano. So there's two from the Czech Republic, one from France. It's a kind of continental ordination today. And this is an incredibly international sangha here. It shows that the awakening to Dhamma isn't a cultural thing. It's because it's happening everywhere, you know, all over the planet. You have people from all over who see, or when they hear the Dhamma, suddenly they connect with it. They recognize it speaks to them. Living here at Amaravati, or in an international community, it's quite a learning process, because you're learning to live with people who are culturally very different from yourself, and that's where the Vinaya and the training is around, not around cultural perceptions, but around a tradition that we assume was established by the Buddha. So it's not trying to to change people's cultural orientation, but to use conventions in order to get beyond even our own cultural attachment. Because in order to be free, you have to transcend your own conditioning. You can't be an American or English or anything. You've got to let go of even your national identity, the gender of your body. These strong views about gender, you know, and rights, women's rights, and male chauvinism, and it goes on, you know, because the traditions from a past, from an ancient past, and so then the people endlessly quibble over the rights of women and monks and so forth, where these can be, you know, rather fraught issues in this day and age to make this terribly important. Or is it really to transcend the identity? So in renunciation, the form that we use is like Theravada tradition. As we've learned it especially in Thailand, from the Thai forest tradition. So that is our precedent in our model, because that's what we've started from. And the adjustment to it in trying to adapt it properly to European society and modern life, but staying within the limits of that tradition, not just trying to go according to modern ideas and trends and fashions, but trying to make it, to allow it to function within the particular society that it exists in a way that allows it to be supported and be respected and to be abused. But still, the main thing is not trying to get on the conventional level perfect, but to transcend even the conventions of Theravada Buddhism. Because the Buddha teaching is to even transcend Buddhism itself. So I mean, you're with mindfulness, then you're going to a place where, you know, Buddhism is a convention that arises and ceases, like anything else. So taking it to just the pure awareness, pure intelligence, pure consciousness, and where before the convention world starts operating, or the self, or the identity. So in order to do that, that's just mindfulness, to be in an open and attentive. You know, the moment you're just paying attention, you're awake, then at this moment, right now, that's all it is. It's so simple that most people never notice, because they're looking for something. So it's just an imminent act of waking up, of being present. And then from there, once you begin to recognize or realize that, then you've got perspective on the conventional world that we live in, such as the form that we have, the conditions and the personalities and of the community and the society that we live in. So then renunciation is ultimately simple. So if just awakeness is no person, it's not complicated. And then I can get complicated when I start thinking about it. was like the analogy of the fish, you know, in the water. I want some water. You say, there's water everywhere. Where is it? You say, it's right, you know, right, it's in you. It's going through you. It's all around you. I don't see any. That's like for us, that's what consciousness is, isn't it? You get, it's everywhere. Where is it? Point it out to me. And so it's not a matter of seeing it, but of being it, isn't it? Being caught, being aware, being awake. So in the training now, like Sabako and Kovetako and Yanadasana, the training is around just the, you know, using convention for awakenment. Because we live with the conventions, they operate, they are the way they are, but then our relationship to them now isn't identifying with them, but in recognizing that conventions are like this. So we restrain ourselves within the convention in terms of action and speech, for example. We live within the restraint of the Vinaya. So that helps to reflect our tendencies to when you have something that, you know, everybody asked to be for the training. So then you have limits placed on behavior and speech. From there, then you can see your own, you know, how the resistance or the rebelliousness or the various ways that we react to restriction or restraint. And I found now just the appreciation of having, rather than just trying to make myself live within the restriction of Vinaya as a kind of, you know, must that I have to do, it's instead of it being something that I have to learn how to live and give up the world and live as a good monk within the restraint of Vinaya, it's more like it makes life so easy because you don't really, you know, it makes it increase so simple and pleasant once you begin to appreciate the beauty of that form, of the samana, or the bhikkhu-bhikkhuni form. And then its relationship to the society, it's always related. The Buddha related the samana to the lay community. So, you know, it's a complementary relationship where you have the beautiful form in the society or this mendicants or samana who are content and grateful and appreciative and kind and compassionate. So a society that doesn't have these is rather sad, isn't it? Yet, when you just a society full of computer programmers or flashy businessmen or, you know, or movie stars or whatever, I mean, here, American politicians. You know, it's not kind of pop stars, rock stars, and that kind of thing. They're kind of fascinating, interesting people, but to have a society full of people like that, you know, it would be a hell realm if there were no arahants or buddhas or samanas. That's why, you know, so many people do get so enthralled when people like the Dalai Lama or, you know, when some particularly religious person becomes highly regarded internationally, it means a lot because we long to see that we long to have Dalai Lamas and saints and Mother Teresa's and and Sufi mystics and selfless beings in the society. And that's why oftentimes people get so angry when people take advantage of it. You know, the scandals around the guru and so forth. You get so irate because, you know, there's such a big disappointment where you put so much hope in somebody as being honest, trustworthy, and worthy of respect. But then people suffer because they want to see it in somebody else and maybe not feel they can do it themselves. Now this is the challenge, isn't it? I remember seeing myself whinging about the fact that, you know, in the United States, you know, 40 years ago, I used to complain, why can't we produce, you know, really outstanding people like Mahatma Gandhi? Why do we always have these kind of mediocrities? Why can't we produce really extraordinary people, saints and spiritually evolved beings? And going on like that, and then the inner voice said, well, why don't you try? You know, you're whinging about and complaining. Why don't you do something about it? And then the emotional world says, oh, I can't do it. No. And I thought, yeah, I want somebody else to do it. I said, you better shut up because you're going around complaining, but am I willing to try? Am I willing to do it? And then that gave me some direction, actually, because after that I put forth a lot of effort trying to not be a saint, but in terms of really trying to understand life and to be worthy of the alms that I receive. And I heard a quote recently from Blake saying, gratitude is heaven itself. And I like this very much because in monastic life, I think one of the heart-opening experiences I had was gratitude. That being an alms mendicant, at first, you know, I kind of understood it theoretically, but I didn't really appreciate it on the heart level. You know, I took it for granted. Then, about the sixth year of my monastic life, I had this gratitude experience. Right, suddenly I felt this incredible gratitude to the Buddha and Lungpa Cha and the Thai people and everybody that's been kind of, you know, supporting, helping, encouraging, feeding, clothing me for those years. And so I found that gratitude then was like it opened something up. The heart-opening experience, because then a kind of devotional side started developing, where before it was mainly just head, you know, kind of ideas of getting, attaining, and very psychological, very kind of Western intellectual attitudes that motivated me. And it wasn't till the katanyu or the gratitude that I started feeling it on a heart level, a real love and appreciation. And like Blake says, gratitude is heaven itself. Because then the holy life became, you know, it was instead of, you know, just trying to make myself practice and try to attain the samadhi and trying to control my desires and all that, then I began to feel that whole kind of sense of self-importance, and that drop tended to started fading out. There was more a trusting joyfulness in the life. So, offer this as a reflection, an encouragement to everybody. On the 9th, we start our winter's retreat. It's named that Chitters. This through end of March. This is well supported by the lay community, that the monks and nuns here can devote themselves to the more formal practices. And it's we really appreciate this, you know, tremendous gratitude to the lay community for coming forth and making this possible. So, because this is a chance to, you know, to really contemplate your own experience, and we need to see that the flow of life, the ordinary life. And also, some people think meditation is just formal practice. You know, you can't meditate unless you have the conditions, very good conditions for it. And that's one extreme. And then others think you shouldn't, you know, you don't need formal conditions, just be mindful in daily life. That's another extreme. And both, you know, they both have their points to make. But one of the advantages of the Samana life is that you do have periods like this where it's possible to kind of remain very silent, still, and to see what happens, and to be willing to accept what happens, no matter what it is. So, I'll close here.